And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, and men's and boys' issues. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and our guest today is Will Patterson. Will lives in the outer east of Melbourne with his partner and son, and he has recently written a book called Mr. Ordinary Goes to Jail. Will, welcome to Dads on the Air.
Oh, g'day. Thank you for having me.
In this book, you've provided answers to some of the questions that I think we all hope to avoid. And one of these might be, what would the ordinary man do if he has an opportunity to take a lot of money and he thinks there is no chance of being caught?
Yep.
You were put in a very extraordinary situation, I think, and we know what you did.
I think that the reason why the book's called Mr. Ordinary Goes to Jail is because I think it's actually a very ordinary situation that I think thousands of Australians would relate to, having financial pressures at home, mortgages and bills and credit card debt, and struggling with how they were going to make ends meet for all of that. And I was, the extraordinary situation I was put in was I was given the temptation, I was given the opportunity to maybe solve that problem by stealing some money from the company that I worked for. And I made the terrible decision, the wrong decision, the ludicrous decision of stealing money from the company I worked for to help make ends meet.
Yes, it was an extraordinary situation, because your name is a little bit unusual with Will, with just W-I-L, and yet The check arrived on your desk for, I think, $5,000, and it was addressed to Will Patterson. I mean, the chances of that are pretty remote, aren't they?
Yeah, pretty remote. I worked in a business where one of my jobs was cancelling checks that were returned to our company. So if we had to pay someone and they didn't leave at their address anymore, the check came back across my desk, I cancelled it, and on the day went. And yes, right in the midst of this pressure and the stress that I had of trying to be the provider for my family and trying to make ends meet for my family and give them a nice life, a cheque landed on the desk in my name, and instead of doing what I was meant to do and cancelling it, I cashed it. And that was, admittedly, that was the first time. And like you said in your intro, I stressed about that for several weeks, and then sort of it came to pass that I thought, I'm actually not being caught for this. Maybe one more time won't hurt. And that was when really my active decision to steal came in. It wasn't just a moment of desperation that met up with a moment of temptation. It was actually a conscious choice to say, well, if I draw another check in that guy's name and send it to his address, it will come back to me and I can cash it again.
Well, you describe yourself as Mr. Ordinary, and in some ways you were. You were working for an insurance company. But do you think your upbringing had any influence on this course of events?
I don't think so. I think quite the opposite, actually. I was brought up by a single dad. My parents separated when I was 6 years old, and so most of my influence in my life was my dad. But my dad is a very moral man, very good man. He brought us up in our local church. I grew up in a generation where our social group was built around church or sporting clubs, not around the internet. And I think that the morals that I was brought up with run pretty strongly contrary to what I did. And so I don't think that can be blamed for what I did. I think that was my own foolish decision, to be honest.
Well, even though your mother left the family when you were only about 6 years old, I think, but you were able to establish a good relationship with your stepmother, weren't you?
Yeah, look, my stepmum didn't come into the picture until I was an adult, and I would never, my whole life, wouldn't have described myself as coming from a broken home. My parents worked really, really hard to make sure that we had two parents involved in our upbringing. You know, we regularly saw mum. Mum was involved in decisions. Mum was invited to birthday parties. You know, and that must have been difficult for them, I think, as parents, as I find it difficult now that I'm not married to my son's mother anymore. But yes, I definitely have an excellent relationship with my stepmum, but my dad didn't marry her until I was in my 30s.
So, yes, you were probably formed by then. And yes. And you say that this was a particularly bad choice, but do you think looking back you made a number of choices, bad choices, before you got to this situation?
Yeah, I think so. I think, as I described in the book, my now ex-wife, my wife at the time, and I weren't, you've heard the expression, keeping up with the Joneses. Mm. I felt like we were the Joneses. We were the family that other people looked to say, oh, well, what they're doing is what we aspire to. You know, we had nice cars, we had nice holidays, we lived a nice lifestyle. And there came a point when I realised that lifestyle was beyond our means. But certainly by that time, I think I put some pressure on myself, and my ex-wife put some pressure on me to continue that lifestyle. That certainly led to a situation where we were in financial stress to start off with. Absolutely.
Your experience with marriage hasn't been that great, really, has it? I mean, you were married a first time to Trix, I think her name was, and she, yeah. And you found out that she was actually violent after you married her.
Yeah, and look, there's a really important part that I left out of the book, because Trix isn't part of this journey. It's not her choice to have her name and her history slathered about in the public eye, and it's not actually her real name. I've used a pseudonym for her to protect her. But the important part of that was, about 18 months before we separated, she started to get violent. She started to have really violent mood swings. There was physical violence from her to me in the marriage by the end. But shortly after we separated, she actually found out that she had a very serious cyst and infection that the doctor said to her at the time before she had surgery, I'm very surprised you didn't notice this. It would have had a massive impact on your emotional well-being, and it was probably giving you pretty big mood swings. So, you know, as it turned out, there was actually something physical that changed her personality from the girl who I married. And I guess the sad thing was it was just a bit too late for us to find that out, that we, you know, the marriage was ruined by the time she found that fact out, unfortunately.
Now, you mentioned your second marriage to Jess and also your child, who your name is CJ.
CJ, yeah.
Are they real names? I mean, is this
no.
sort of... Okay.
No. So most of the names in the book have been changed. I think it's really important to keep a step away from my child, which is why I've used CJ for him. This was my decision to tell my story.
And now you're currently in a good relationship, you know, after all the trials and traumas. So you've found yourself in a good place after all this.
Yeah, it's been a long road, but and I wasn't looking for anything. The thing that I laugh with my friends about is I've got a couple of mates who have been in similar situations to me, and I'm sure there's a lot of dads out there who would relate to it, that a marriage has ended and so now you have a relationship with your kids that isn't full time. And you have to sort of build yourself a little single life when you're not with them. And you build yourself a life and it goes along nicely and you've got your friends and you've got your time with your kid and everything's ticking along really well. And then you meet a girl who messes it all up in the most wonderful way, but she wrecks it because all of a sudden you don't want what you've built as a little single life. You want something with her. And so now you've got to do it all over again, which Christina and I have done that. She and my son adore each other, and I'm really glad that they do, because if he hadn't got along with her, I would have given that relationship up. I knew that he would get along with her, though, because, you know, I adore her, and he's a bit like me, so.
Yes, I think one thing that, as a result of your experiences, you're able to set a good set of priorities, I'm sure.
Yeah.
We're speaking today with Will Patterson, who is the author of a new book called Mr. Ordinary Goes to Jail. And, Will, you've asked us to play a song for you. Could you tell us which song it is and why you picked it?
Yeah, sure. So the first song I asked you to play is by an American country band called the Zac Brown Band. I'm a big lover of country music as I've matured in life, and it's quite an upbeat song. It's called Uncaged, and it was the first song that I asked to be played in the car on the day that I left prison. The title's probably quite obvious. It's called Uncaged, and it's all about being out in the open and setting your spirit free and not stopping until you reach the ocean. And it's just a really nice, it was a great thing to yell down the highway as we drove down the Hume Highway home.
Set my spirit free. Won't stop till I reach the ocean. Gonna break these chains holding me. Uncaged. Gonna swim in the coldest river. Gonna drink from a mountain spring. Deep in the land of the gray wide ocean. Let the water roll all over me. I'm given to the wind through the open plains. Freedom is a gift, get living. Go chase that sunset highway down. You got to get
uncaged. We're dads, we're dads on the air. We're dads, we're dads on the air.
And that was Uncaged by the Zac Brown Band, specially chosen for us today by our guest Will Patterson, who is the author of a new book called Mr. Ordinary Goes to Jail. Will, we're just talking about you now in this good relationship. Have you got any main lessons that you think have come from your experience of spending 9 months in jail?
Yes, I think that there's an expression in jail which is do your own time. It's a piece of advice you get given by other inmates, do your own time. In prison, what that means is don't get involved in anybody else's drama and don't let anybody else get involved in your drama. You're there to do a stint. You're going to go home at the end of the stint and just don't get messy, don't get involved in other people's business. But since I've come home, and I came home in February 2015, that expression has grown to mean a bit more to me. What it really means to me is we only get to live this life once, so don't let anybody else make decisions for you. If somebody asks you to do something that's against your moral code, just don't do it. If you're not sure about where to go to the people that love you and talk to them first. But do your own time. Do the things that you want to do the way you want to do them, and everybody else can go hang. And that, you know, I took some time while I was in prison to reflect on what was really important to me. And what's really important to me is, you know, my relationship with my son, my relationship with my fiance, my relationships in general, my family, my friends. You know, I used to be a man who was very focused on things, and now I'm a man who's very focused on relationships. Mm. And that's really the big thing that I've learned.
Now, you just mentioned your time in jail, and you had some, you still probably have some big fears, and one of those is violence. But you were you able to escape any of the violence that we hear about in, that happens in prisons?
The violence that we hear about that happens in prisons is actually pretty rare, to be honest. I had one experience of it when I was at Port Phillip Prison, which is Victoria's maximum security prison. I was quite fortunate that for most of the time that I was in a low security prison in a Victorian country town called Beechworth. And perhaps because of that, I've had a more positive experience of prison than some people would have. But the prison that I was at didn't have high instances of violence. It was easy to avoid if you weren't a smart aleck. A lot of the snapped violence, I think, in prison comes from the fact that there's, you know, 100 odd blokes all in one sort of compacted area. You don't have a lot of your own space or your own time to think. And if somebody encroaches on that, people tend to snap. So the only time I saw people snap or had people snap at me was that, where you sort of metaphorically stepped on somebody else's toes. Their response to that was to be quick to anger. But Wentworth and Prisoner and Orange is the New Black and prison documentaries don't prepare you for prison any better than Scooby-Doo prepares you for solving mysteries.
You were sentenced to 9 months. You think there's a difference between, say, someone in for that length of time as distinct from someone who's maybe got a life sentence? Do you notice a difference between the prisoners in jail?
Yeah, I think so. Again, the prison that I was at, there was basically two types of prisoners there. There was people like me who were white-collar criminals who only had a short sentence. And there was people who were coming to the end of a long sentence. So one of the gentlemen that I was in jail with was coming to the end of a 17-year stint, and he was in his last 18 months of jail. So he certainly had a very different view on the world to what I did. He had very different fears and concerns than what I did. He was very concerned about how the world had changed for him when he got to go home. But because I mostly had to do with, for the old-timers, people were coming to the end of their sentences, they didn't want to do anything to muck it up. So they were all very sort of well-behaved, if that makes sense. Their impending sense of fear at getting out was very different to my impending looking forward to getting out. They were as worried about how the world had changed as they were happy about going back out into the world.
What do you see as the purpose of prison? I mean, there are three aims. You know, there's the punishment, the rehabilitation, and then there's perhaps keeping people off the street. Do you think any one of those is the main purpose, or any of them?
I think, unfortunately, punishment's the main one, and I think that's why our prisons are less effective than they could be. And again, I stress this is personal opinion, but there was very little in the way of rehabilitation courses for people who were coming to an end of a long stint and going out into society. There was very little in terms of making sure you were rehabilitated. It was more about what the guards wanted you to do was keep your head down, do what you were told and go home. An example of that I can give you is, and it might be different now, might have changed the day I left, but for the period of time that I was at Beechworth, my rough estimate, because every day you line up to get medication from the chemist, and I was on anxiety medication, I would suggest that about a third of the prison would line up each day to get some form of medication. For the period of time that I was at that jail, there was no psychological counselling or support services available at all. If we want to have a good balance between punishing people when they deserve to be punished, and I'll put my hand up and say I absolutely deserve to be punished, and sending people back into society better than they were when they went in, we really need to look at some of those things and some of the programs that we provide people.
Yeah, I think you sort of undertook some of your own therapy with, you managed to get a pet that you could relate to.
yeah, kind of.
A wedge-tailed eagle, of all things.
Yes.
Temujin, I think. Well,
yes.
Is that sort of like the prisoner of Alcatraz with the bird that used to come visit him, I think. But was it a big help to you?
Yeah, it was. That came about because I decided to study while I was away, and I studied a zookeeping course. And again, I was fortunate with the prison that I was at because Beechworth Prison has an association with Zoos Victoria, and so they have a rehabilitation centre for injured wildlife in the area. And Temujin was a older female wedge-tailed eagle who was basically going to be with us at the prison until she died because she wasn't able to fly. But certainly spending time with her every day and observing her and writing a diary for my study was really cathartic for me. The amazing thing about animals is animals don't lie. Animals don't have any pretense. You know, I had to take my time and build up trust with Temi. And, you know, I started off by sitting outside her enclosure and just I would go with a book and I'd read her the book. And at first she'd ignore me and then she'd look for me when I would come down around the same time. And then I started sitting inside the enclosure with her and then sitting a little bit closer with her. And by about halfway through my time, she'd come and sit next to me or she'd sit on my arm. And the most beautiful thing she'd do is she'd tuck her head into your chest. And if you stroke the back of her neck, she'd purr like a cat. So she'd come for cuddles basically by the end. That's anthropomorphizing her, but that's what she'd do. She'd come for affection. She'd get her affection and then she'd trot off and I'd sit there and read my book to her and we'd just hang out for an hour or so and then I'd go off and continue whatever the work was that I was doing in the prison that day. It was incredibly good for my soul.
Look, that's a great story. And look, you've told us what you did when you got out. You were going down the highway singing out a song. But look, we've reached the stage, Sarah, where we asked you to pick a song for the program. Could you tell us the other song you picked and why you picked it?
Yeah, sure. So the other song's a Paul Kelly song, and it's called How to Make Gravy. And the premise of the song is that it's a man who's in prison writing to his family at Christmas time, and he's writing to them about, if I'm not there, who's going to make the gravy for Christmas dinner. But the song's about a lot more than that. It's about loss and about all the things that he's going to miss out on and about all the things that he's afraid of are going to happen while he's away. And I felt a lot of those feelings. The biggest deprivation is deprivation of your family when you're in jail, not being able to be a part of the day-to-day life of your family. And this song just really touches me in a very different way now that I've been in jail than it did beforehand. So, yeah, How to Make Gravy.
Hello, Dan. It's Joe here. I hope you're keeping well. It's the 21st of December. Now they're ringing the last bell. If I get good behavior, I'll be out of here by July. Won't you kiss my kids on Christmas Day? Please don't let them cry for me. I guess the brothers are driving down from Queensland and Stella's flying in from the coast. They say it's gonna be 100 degrees, even more maybe. But that won't stop the road. Who's gonna make the gravy now? I bet it won't taste the same. Just that flour, salt, a little red wine. Get a dollar for tomato sauce, for sweetness and that extra tang. And give my love to Angus and to Frank and Dolly. Tell them all I'm sorry. I screwed up this time. And look out the reader. I'll be thinking of her early Christmas morning.
How to Make Gravy by Paul Kelly, and our special guest today has been Will Patterson, who is the author of Mr. Ordinary Goes to Jail. Will, it just remains for me now to thank you very much for being on the program.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed my time.
Oh, look, that's great. And don't forget, we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, send us an email and we'll be in touch. If you'd like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, or you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And we'll be back next week with another show on Dads on the Air.